You're listening to TIP.
So if you're a high W-2 earner, and like hands down, like one tax strategy just never goes out of style is you have, you know, one spouse is a high W-2 earner, and the other spouse can manage rental property, right? So the idea is that you're one of qualified for real estate professional. The idea is that you can take the high W-2, the one spouse can, you know, manage the rental properties, qualify for real estate professional status. That would then unlock any losses that are generated from the property. So now you can do things like cost segregation and bonus depreciation to really draw up that loss, and you can use that to offset the W-2 income.
Hey guys, in today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down and talking with Grant Doherty, a Houston-based tax professional who specializes in real estate and small business tax strategies. You'll hear about the lessons Grant learned playing college baseball and how he's applied that to his professional life, how he got his accounting practice started, what some of his favorite tax strategies are, what are some important financial moves real estate investors and small business owners should make, what the biggest mistakes he sees people making on their taxes, and a whole lot more. This episode will be released on April 15th, Tax Day, so hopefully you'll learn some important tax strategies that you can employ to help save you money and compound your wealth. Without further delay, let's dive into today's episode with Grant Doherty.
Celebrating 10 years, you are listening to Millennial Investing by the Investors Podcast Network. Since 2014, we interviewed successful entrepreneurs, business leaders, and investors to help educate and inspire the millennial generation. Now for your host, Patrick Donnelly.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Millennial Investing Podcast. I'm your host today, Patrick Donnelly, and joining me in today's studio is Grant Doherty. Grant, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me, Pat. It's great, man. I'm glad to be here. Hopefully, we get to talk about some taxes, man, because that's what always excites me.
That's what we're going to get into for sure. The different, you know, small business advantages, real estate advantages, different things that people can do to take advantage of just saving in taxes, which I think we're all for. I wanted to start off first about, I found out that you played college baseball, which I'm fascinated. Yeah. I really love interviewing guys that have been athletes. I've had some professional, you know, NFL football players, and I just really enjoy talking to athletes. So I just wanted to hear just a little bit about maybe the lessons that you learned playing both high school, college baseball, and how you've applied those lessons to what you're doing now. Like, how has that impacted your life and career?
There's like several lessons that I would have learned, right? You know, you got to learn how to be a good teammate and work together with, you know, to, you know, with a team to achieve a common goal. And, you know, that's probably one. And that really applies to business now. But some of the other things, so like in baseball, if you are a pitcher, you know, you're going to give up a bomb that just comes at the wrong time. You may lose the game. You may be a hitter that goes, oh, for his next 20 at bats. Or maybe you're the one that strikes out and ends the game with a strikeout, right? You have to come with that humility. And I think that was something that I also learned is, you know, baseball is definitely a very humbling sport, and you have to take that humility and apply it to business. But probably the biggest lesson I learned was in college baseball. Yeah, you have freaks of nature, and you have guys that are just like, you know, unbelievably talented athletes. But the broad majority of people, right, are all, you know, once we get to that college level and even like you go to the next level, everyone is good at that point. But the thing that really separates the good from the great is who makes the less fundamental mistakes, right? You know, it's the fundamentals that really separate the good from the great. And, you know, yeah, you can make the diving play, you can be, you know, super fast, super strong, but if you can fundamentally be very sound and try to make as few mistakes fundamentally as possible, you will see success. And that lesson right there is really transferred over well for life and just business in general.
I interviewed a guy named Chris Kerner, who's on Twitter. That's how you and I got connected, was Twitter. Yeah. But Chris had a post where he talked about his preference in hiring people, specifically salespeople, were college athletes, D1 athletes. He's like, by far, those are the best guys to hire. Can you speak to that a little bit? Like, why that is, do you think?
So I'm not too sure, you know, scientifically what the reasoning would be behind, but I do know that whenever you are involved in any type of like college athletic sport or, you know, you're, and a lot of college athletes can attest to this, but you have to be very disciplined and you have to be very meticulous with your times, right? You know, constantly throughout the day, you got to go to class, then you got to go to workouts, then you got to go to practice. Then, you know, at my school, the freshmen, sophomores, and juniors who didn't have a certain GPA, you had to go to study hall, mm-hmm. right? So you had to learn how to use your time wisely and use it to your most, and you have to be multi-skilled, right? You can't just only be a good athlete. You don't, you know, get the grades, you know, you're not going to be playing, right? So, you know, that would be probably my reasoning behind it. I'm not too sure if that's really what it is, but yeah, you know, that was something that I learned whenever I was younger was time management. And, you know, I feel like that transfers over not just to sales, but just business and life in general. You know, that's another great skill that people need to learn how to have. It's just time management, using their time wisely, focus on your strengths and outsource your weaknesses.
I like that. My wife, I told you, is a therapist, and one of her favorite books is a book called Grit. And it's, I think that's another factor. It's just athletes develop grit. They develop perseverance. And, you know, like you said, getting the fundamentals down and just sticking to it and just learning to grind is like such a big part of success in anything. Yeah. It doesn't matter what it is.
Having that competitive nature and just like that killer instinct. If you're an athlete, you know, you definitely have that instinct. You know, I call it the killer instinct. I'm not actually mean killer, right?
No,
I'm
get,
talking about just like that competitiveness to always want to win.
Yeah. The NCAA basketball tournament's going on now as we're recording this. And I just love to watch the athletes, both the men and the women, just like their drive. And I think it's like such a fascinating sporting event to watch.
I almost feel like it's more intense than like sometimes, you know, with the professionals, right? You know, once my money gets involved, we'll start. Now, granted, you know, college athletes are getting paid for like their endorsements and stuff now, but it's still a little different, man. I feel like you got more to prove whenever you're still a college athlete versus, you know, now you're a multimillionaire professional athlete.
Yeah, no doubt. I want to talk a little bit about, so you're playing baseball in college. When did money and investing and all of that, like what are some of your first memories of that?
So, you know, growing up, we didn't really talk too much about like, we talked about budgeting, right? You know, it was more very basic budgeting, not really too much on investing. But when I went to school, so I studied business, you know, I majored in management, I minored in finance and accounting. And then I went and got an MBA. So I was in a school, you know, constantly around business and money. So it was funny because back then when I was in school, I was just trying to get good grades, right? You know, I got the hang of like how this thing is supposed to work and I can make good grades. But it wasn't until I got my first corporate America job. That's whenever it finally all hit and I'm starting to get paychecks and I have a 401k and, you know, I have to pay taxes, you know, all this other stuff. That's when it's like, oh, this is what is really going on, right? So it was that experience that really finally like tipped me over. And once when that started happening, that's when I started talking to my parents about like, hey, do y'all invest your money? And that's when they told me they had a financial advisor. So then I started looking into that. And that was like essentially my first real exposure to just like handling money in general. Whenever I actually started to like legit earn money and like corporate America. Because I in college, you know, coming up, I worked retail. You know, I would work retail jobs. So I mean, that was a little bit of money. That's still budgeting. You know, I wasn't making enough money to like, okay, now I have free money to go and invest in the 401k. Or I was basically just making enough to essentially pay my bills and pay my food and kind of keep it moving, man. But yeah, that was probably my first exposure to like actually investing. And, you know, so a lot of the research I had to do on my own, or I would have learned about it in school. And then once when it started to apply personally to me, now it's just like I'm taking that next step. So maybe I focus on Intelligent Investor was a great book that I read. Now, granted, you need a little bit of background knowledge going into an Intelligent Investor to be able to read it, right? But that to me was probably the tipping point is like, oh, okay, well, I think now I know how to invest. Oh, I'm getting into like life insurance because I have three kids, right? So I don't necessarily invest in life insurance as like an investment per se, but for my three kids and my family, you know, I know how important that is to an overall portfolio. So, you know, I got, you know, life insurance to cover that. I got my investments in both like 401ks and taxable brokerage accounts. And then, you know, you start to learn a little bit about real estate, right? And so you start getting involved into the tax world. So now you're like, that's what, you know, I didn't just immediately come out as a tax advisor, right? And I had to get my interest sparked. I wanted to learn how to file more taxes. So I started reaching out to different mentors that I knew. Hey, can I kind of file your tax return? I won't even charge you. I just want to like get used to it. And so that's now you start learning about real estate investing. You start learning about, oh, I could passively invest in this business, right? And then you start really like getting access to like all sorts of different ideas and just experiences.
It's a whole world out there that I think a lot of business owners, they just rely on their CPA, hoping that they keep up on everything. And it's hard even for a CPA to keep up on everything. So, I mean, I feel like as a small business owner, you've got to take the onus has to be a little bit on you. You've got to pay attention to like all the different things that are out there, or at least be able to ask some questions about it and figure out what's going on. I wanted to hear, were you pretty set on becoming an accountant, CPA, financial guy, like going, you know, when you're in college, or it just kind of unfolded?
No, yeah, it just kind of unfolded, man. You know, of course, whenever you're young and you're an athlete and you can run kind of fast, you think that you have a chance of going to the pros. Like that was like always my initial, like, oh, I want to go pro. And then even after that, I was like, if I don't go pro, I'm going to be someone's sports agent, or I'm going to be someone, some professional's agent. And it didn't work out like that, right? So then that's when I took the corporate America route. And, you know, I just got exposed to what else is all out there. And that's where it really like changed my focus. You know, it started off, you know, the whole tax business really started off as something very small. I didn't think it was going to get as big as what it did. So one of the things that I researched is, you know, whenever I was first getting started out, what business could I actually go and start? That's when I figured out that like, oh, I could probably own my own business and kind of make more money than what I'm making. What business could I start? And I already knew I was very skilled at, you know, accounting and finance and taxes, but I needed the experience. So that's when I started reaching out to people who I knew at, you know, local firms that had, you know, a sizable number of returns. And I actually would, you know, tell them, hey, can I just, you know, file it for free? And so that's how I essentially got my exposure, got started to get my practice, started to see like different situations. And when I was ready, you know, that's when I started taking off and trying to do my own returns. Start off, again, very small. It's not like I just immediately jumped right into like, I'm going to be a real estate tax advisor. Like, no, I'm just going to be a tax preparer. Mm-hmm. And then you start to, you know, build connections with different CPAs and enrolled agents. And then you start finding out like, okay, you can actually niche down and focus on this specific sector. And I'm like, okay, well, that's not a bad idea. So you start learning more. And now you're like, okay, well, I'm going to put my money in there. So now you're getting exposure from not only helping your clients, but also real life exposure.
I wanted to take a little step back though. Like, what was that first like corporate career job that you initially took? Like your W-2 job, what was that?
Yeah, it was, so I worked at a company called Sysco. Sysco Foods is actually headquarters here in Houston. And I was working in like, it's kind of hard to describe. I would call it their finance, accounting, tax division. It's the one I was doing. It was called Billbacks, with a very Sysco generic term. It probably doesn't apply to anywhere else, but it was very corporate specific. Now, I didn't learn like great skills when I was there, but it was, you know, some of like the key things that I learned would have been very specific to just only Sysco. Wouldn't have applied anywhere else. But I got pretty good at what I did there. I had enough free time to like, I would just go into work, clock in, clock out, go home. I got all this extra free time. That's where I started to pick up like, okay, hey, what else can I really do? Like, can I invest my money? Oh, hey, maybe I could start this small business and let me get a little bit of exposure into like how the industry works. But I could probably start off kind of small, keep my W-2 and have a, you know, side tax business. But I had no idea it was going to grow as big as it is. You know, eventually I would just solely only focus on my tax business, and it's just continuing to grow. Now it's to the point where I need to probably start hiring out and having other people come in and help me.
Well, I want to get into that a little bit. Like, how did you grow it? Like, you know, you're in this W-2 Sysco job. What stage did you leave that where you felt comfortable to be like, I can give this up, I can go 100% whole hog into this new business? And how did you grow the business?
Social media, you know, so I had started the journey back in like 2018, 2019 is when I first started that journey. But once when COVID hit and we're at home and it's like, now we really got a lot of time. And that's also when people are now on social media. So I then created a page dedicated solely to just like, I'm going to give people good tax tips, right? I'm not trying to like, you know, you find all sorts of things on social media, but I try to keep it pretty by the book and just give people ideas. And it just grew, you know, it didn't grow overnight. You know, I had to, you know, consistently post. I had to build relationships on, and, you know, my biggest page is actually my Instagram, but I'm starting to get a little bit of a follow on Twitter as well. I would say like 85% of my clientele comes straight from social media. And so that's basically where I grew the business from. And what I officially went full time in like 2021 sometime. I can't remember now. That's whenever I first officially started focusing solely on the business. And even when I did that, now when I had all my time to focus on, I started noticing all these different inconsistencies in my business, right? So one of the things I quickly wanted to do is I need to take my, I need to like stop touching as much stuff. I need automation. So that once when I learned automation, that like opened me up to a whole new realm.
I wanted to get into that too, like your tech stack, you know, for a small business person. There's a lot of people that, you know, have a small business that listen to this or want to have a small business. What kind of tech stack do you recommend for like somebody, let's say they're a real estate investor, or let's stick to a real estate investor. What would you say like their tech stack should be?
The key to a real estate investor is definitely going to be, you need to have a profit and loss statement and a balance sheet. Like that's going to be like almost like your compass to doing anything. And most commonly, I think most real estate investors would really like Stessa. Stessa is a bookkeeping software that is really dedicated to real estate investors. However, probably the most common and widely used software out there is going to be QuickBooks. And if you ever needed to hire a bookkeeper, you could probably find someone a lot easier if you already have QuickBooks on versus like, I think they can, you know, some bookkeepers are good at Stessa, but QuickBooks is more widely used.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guys trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host. Hey guys, have you ever wondered if there's an AI tool like ChatGPT specifically built for the stock market? A tool that not only does the research and analysis for you, but also allows for dynamic discussions? Well, wonder no more. Meet Meka, your AI-powered stock research assistant, now enhanced with real-time stock data. Let Meka do the heavy lifting for you to significantly reduce your research time. And the best part, Meka is 100% free. Ask Meka questions like, explore the financial health of Apple through a summary of its balance sheet. Compare the financial statements of Apple and Tesla. What is the analyst price target for Microsoft? What is the social sentiment analysis of Amazon? And millions of other queries right at your fingertips. Visit Meka.com. That's Meyka.com.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement. All right, back to the show.
Right. Talk to me more about like your ideal client right now. Like what you're specifically focused on. You said you wanted to niche down. So what is that niche that you're going to focus on in your ideal client?
Yeah, so I do try to go towards a lot of people that are investing in real estate. I do still work with a lot of small business owners because small business taxes will never go out of style. You always have, you know, that's the backbone essentially of America is the small business. So I still do work with small businesses, but I tried to like, you know, once when you start making like, you know, depending on how everything is, but once we start making like $5, $10 million or more, I'll probably have to cut it off and like, okay, hey, you know, you're probably getting a little too big for what I really want to handle. Cause now you need to start looking at other things like maybe you should be a C corp or like, things can get like a little complicated. And unless you have a strategy to like then devote it, you know, maybe take your profits and funnel it over to real estate, I'll probably just hand you off because the real estate in my experience is definitely where a lot of like, whenever you have hundreds of thousands of dollars of potential tax deductions from things like cost segregation, if you use that to potentially offset your income, that's up my alley of like, you know, what I'm very familiar with. I've studied the passive activity loss audit technique guide and like all the different IRS publications they have out there. So that's just like you know, whenever you get like more in depth into taxes, there's everyone have a niche, right? So you have like trust taxation, you have nonprofit taxation. Maybe you want to focus on retirement income. There's all different niches. And I just happen to really, I like the real estate. And then I don't discount my small business owners. So a lot of the people who I work with, high W-2 that invest in real estate or a high business. And when I say high business, no more than 5 to 10 million that also invest in real estate. That's going to be my typical client now.
Let's get into that. The advantages of a high W-2 earner married to a real estate, what is it? A real estate professional, REPS, I think it's called. Talk to me about how people can think about that and like the advantages of it.
So if you're a high W-2 earner and like hands down, like one tax strategy just never goes out of style is you have, you know, one spouse is a high W-2 earner and the other spouse can manage rental property, right? So the idea is that you want to qualify as a real estate professional, which that alone is its own nuance. Like you probably have an entire time right. on just real estate professional status. But the idea is that you can take the high W-2, the one spouse can, you know, manage the rental properties, qualify for real estate professional status. That would then unlock any losses that are generated from the property. So now you can do things like cost segregation and bonus depreciation to really draw up that loss and you can use that to offset the W-2 income. Now, there's like all sorts of different ways this could go because what if you have two spouses and both of them have high W-2 incomes? Then that probably takes that strategy off the table. But now you could look at something like maybe a short-term rental, which is there's a special carve out under section 469 for short-term rentals. And so that's another option that.
So say more about that. If it's two high income W-2 earners, they buy a short-term Airbnb. Can they then, if they're managing it, doing the day-to-day, you know, I forget what the percentage is, I'm not sure, but like if they're doing most of the management of the Airbnb, can they then become a real estate professional status?
So the terminology, you know, it means everything in like the tax world. So whenever you have an Airbnb, generally the average tenant is going to stay for only a few days. Well, the IRS they have section 469, which talks about passive activity losses, but they have special exceptions to the rules of what is considered a rental activity. And one of those special carve outs is that the average tenant stays for 7 days or less. And if that is true, you don't have a quote unquote rental activity. And so if you don't have a rental activity, you actually don't have to qualify for real estate professional status. Instead, you have more of an active business. And in order to treat it as non-passive, you would have to just meet one of the seven material participation tests. Now, generally, you can meet that test if you manage the property, if you self-manage the property, but you have to document your time and you have to understand which tests are you going to go for because like you said, there's seven of them. You only need to meet one of them, but each one has their own nuance to it. So it's definitely something you want to work with a tax advisor that's very familiar with it because you started talking about like what is material participation? Like what is actually considered active management of the property? And then what I always try to tell people is I try to go through like what is not considered material participation. And so generally, if you want to sum it up, consider like investor related hours or like travel time. So like driving to and from these properties generally won't count. And then sitting down and just like reviewing like tax returns and income statements and, you know, bills and things like that. Generally, unless it's part of your day-to-day activities of the property, that would be considered investor related hours and the any hours wouldn't count that. So generally what I like to see is communication with guests, going and maintaining the property. You know, maybe if you had to like fix anything or do some renovations on it prior to like getting it ready, that would be material participation. That's what I like to generally see to qualify for those tests.
You had mentioned cost segregation and bonus depreciation. There's a lot of our listeners that have no idea what that is. Can you go into that a little bit? Like what is cost segregation and the advantages of that?
So before we get started, bonus depreciation. Depreciation is just a deduction you can claim. So whenever you have an asset, let's say you buy a car, in a few years, that car is not going to be as good as what it was when it was brand new because of the wear and tear. The IRS allows you to claim a deduction based on what they generally consider is the wear and tear of an asset over its life. So for example, a car has a 5-year lifespan, depreciable lifespan. Now, every asset has a depreciable life. And if it's 20 years or less, it qualifies for bonus depreciation, which is just a way where, okay, if you I probably won't use a car because those are special, but let's just say you have a five-year asset. Generally, you just divide by five. If it's a $100,000 property, you get $20,000 deduction every year. But with bonus depreciation, if let's say it's a 100% bonus depreciation, you can get that full deduction upfront in year one. That's basically what bonus depreciation is.
Which creates a huge loss for the property or potentially, right?
Yeah, but here's the trick with real estate. So whenever we buy a rental property, rental properties, if they're residential, depreciate at 27 and a half years, and commercial properties are depreciated at 39 years. But when you buy a rental, you're not only buying the structure of the building. You know, sometimes it comes with a parking lot. Maybe it comes with a driveway or a sidewalk or landscaping or furniture or carpeting or lighting. It comes with all these different things that could technically fall under 5, 7, or even 15-year property. And that's where the bonus depreciation aspect kind of comes in. And, you know, you can go in, do a cost seg, go and analyze the property and say, like, hey, this is the five-year property. And depending on like what the bonus appreciation is that year, in 2024, it's 60%. So if you have, you know, $100,000 of a five-year property, you'll get a $60,000 upfront deduction plus any remaining bonus straight line appreciation after that.
Which is huge. I mentioned Mitchell Baldridge. I had him on the show half a year ago or so, but he said that only about like 3-5% of real estate investors take advantage of cost segregation, which I found shocking.
Yeah, that is shocking. I probably have a warped perspective just because I work with, you know, a lot of the clients who I work with, I'm always bringing it up to them. So, you know, the people who I work with are informed, but if I had to put a number on it, that's really interesting. I wouldn't be able to tell you that if what percentage of people know about it and don't. I would believe it, though. I'm definitely not discounting.
It's an interesting thing. And is it something that you typically would recommend to your clients, like if they own real estate, if they're going to hold on to it? Because there is this thing called recapture tax, right?
It depends. You know, a few factors that I would look at. So number one, are they in a low tax year? Are they expecting their income to be higher next year, right? That would be one thing that I look at is, okay, if we are going to be able, so I guess the first thing is like, is this going to be a non-passive loss or is this going to be a passive loss? That's probably the very first thing I look at. But then after that, I'm going to say like, okay, if let's just say you can use this loss against your income. Are you in a high tax year or are you going to probably have more income next year? I mean, we probably need to spread out this deduction over a few years. Then we also look at exit strategies. How long are you planning to hold this property? And here's the thing, that conversation can be tough with people because of course you talk to someone, they're like, oh, I plan to hold this property until I retire. But then I start talking to them about like how financially of a crunch is it to actually meet the bills and take care of this property? And you quickly find out that, you know, there are a few rentals that absolutely boom with cash flow, but then the majority of them are going to be pretty consistent. It's not going to just be boom. And if there comes a hard time, right? What if all of a sudden people stop going on vacation and now you're not meeting your bills? Are you going to sell your property then? That's where people don't understand, right? Yeah. People never see that aspect of things. And so that's where that conversation kind of comes into play is like, okay, if you're going to do a cost seg, I want you to hold this property for at least, you know, it depends, 5, 6, 7 years before it actually starts to make sense.
The reason I found you was you did a post on all the different tax advantages of real estate that really caught my eye. What are some other ones? We've talked about cost segregation. Are there some other ones that you can talk about that are great for real estate investors?
There's a ton of them out there, man. So let's just say that you're unbelievably profitable, your rentals, and you have $100,000 of rental profit when it's all said and done. That rental profit is not subject to Social Security and Medicare tax. So if you take someone who has a W-2, yeah, maybe the federal income tax rate is about the same, but the W-2 earner is paying Social Security and Medicare, whereas the real estate investor doesn't have those taxes. So like that's a big advantage that I always tell people is that, you know, you have that passive treatment of rental income. But even after that, right, you know, you start getting into, if you sell a property, you got capital gains. Of course, you do have to worry about depreciation recapture, but here's the cool thing about just depreciation recapture and capital gains in general. Depreciation recapture, I'm not going to say that it is a capital gain. It's a type of capital gain. It'll be recaptured at your ordinary income rates, but tax loss harvesting can actually offset not only capital gains, but also your depreciation recapture. So like there's ways that you can mitigate, you know, if you can dispose of a property, you could tax loss harvest against it. Maybe you could do a 1031 exchange into a new property.
go into that a little bit, because a lot of people might not know that terminology. What is tax loss harvesting? How does that come about?
Yeah, so tax loss harvesting, if you have a capital gain, you know, that's whenever you have an asset, let's just say you got some stocks or bonds or even like a rental property. If you buy it at 100 grand and you sell it for 300 grand, you have a $200,000 capital gain. Now, if you also have stocks in the stock market, it's like a rough year, and maybe you sell some stocks at a $150,000 capital loss, you can use that loss to offset some of your capital gain. And that's essentially what tax loss harvesting is. Now, here's the thing. A lot of people get caught up in like, oh, well, I should just go invest in some, you know, really bad stock and just draw a loss. I'm like, no, that's not the idea. The idea is you have a diversified portfolio. And if you have a diversified portfolio and you're in the US and you're in this market, I'm not a financial advisor. Let me just get that out. So like, don't take my advice, but you know, take it with a grain of salt. But the idea is you have a diversified portfolio. And whenever that happens, some of your portfolio is up, some of your portfolio is down. So you could actually use the part that's down, sell that off, and lock in that capital loss and use that to offset your capital gain.
What about a 1031 exchange? You hear that a lot, real estate investors talking about that. Explain what a 1031 exchange is and if you recommend that or not.
Yeah, so a 1031 exchange is just essentially the way that a real estate investor can essentially sell their property and then they can use the gains and roll it over into a new property. Now, if you sell a property at 300K, you have to basically trade up. So if you sell a property at 300K, you got to go get a new property that's at least 300K or more in value. Otherwise, if you sell it at 300 and you go and get a new property at 250, you're going to have $50,000 of taxable gain. Now, there's a lot of nuances to like a 1031 exchange. They can be great. I do think that 1031 exchanges can be great for investors, but there's, like I said, a lot of nuances. Number one, I think probably the biggest mistake I see people make, or not necessarily a mistake, but a misconception, is that they can just sell the property, they can take all the money, and they can just roll it over to a new property to still qualify. And you actually need a qualified intermediary to essentially take that money from you, and they will hold the money and they'll essentially, you know, continue the transaction for you. But that's like something that I run across, man. And then if you boil it down to like different states have different clawback rules. So you have to like file those forms with the states every single year.
And you also only have, what, about 6 months, right, to make that next purchase, which that can bite people in the butt, too, if they don't haven't identified something.
And it's crazy. So whenever you are, depending on, like, when you're trying to do this, right, because, number one, you never want to tell someone that you're doing a 1031. Besides your qualified intermediary and your tax advisor, don't tell your real estate agent, oh, by the way, I'm doing a 1031 exchange. Because guess what? Now, if they know anything about real estate, they'll know that you are on a time crunch. And if you don't think they won't use that to their advantage, they certainly will, right? So have some planning involved, because like you said, you have 45 days to identify. And then of the ones that you identify, you have 180 days to close. So you can identify multiple properties if you wanted to, but you can't identify some and then say, oh, I'm not doing that. I'm going to go get someone else and buy that one. It doesn't work that way. So that's another nuance you have to keep in mind.
Let's get into small business owners and some of the different tax strategies that you recommend your new clients, like, you know, right off the bat, like here's one, two, three things that should be doing.
Oh, I'm big on retirement accounts. So if you're self-employed, you have no employees, I like the solo 401k. I think it's a huge benefit to solo print. And, you know, there's also SEP IRA, there's simple IRAs if you have employees, but definitely with retirement accounts. That's like one of the very first things that I look at. It's like, I always tell people that, you know, it's not something that you need to take advantage of, but at least you have it in your back pocket. So if you ever want to pull it out and use it, you can do that. And then of course, you know, I'm all about like investing back into the business and like trying to reclaim your time back. So I'm big on hiring employees or contractors to essentially save you on work time. You can get a tax deduction that way. And then, you know, depending on like the type of employee, you may get credits for, you know, starting up a retirement plan or like whatever the case may be, you know, there's different employee credits you can get. But then if you use, maybe you have a business where you have to use a vehicle a lot for your business. You know, now we start looking into like different vehicle types of deductions. And, you know, do you want to get a vehicle that's over 6,000 pounds, if it's under 6,000 pounds?
So if it's over 6,000 pounds, what's the advantage of that?
So whenever you get a vehicle, right, you can claim deductions for using a vehicle. There's two ways to go about it. There's the actual method there's the standard method. The standard method, just calculate the total business miles you drove, and you multiply by a set standard rate, boom, that's your deduction. Then there's the actual method where you got to go in, you got to still track your miles, but let's just say you use it for 60% business usage. Well, you can deduct 60% of all the expenses related to that vehicle, including like gas, tire changes, oil changes, things like that, including depreciation. All right. Now, the depreciation is a huge part of like why people go and get vehicles. And the reason why 6,000 pound or greater vehicles are more strategic is the IRS actually allows you to claim more of a depreciation deduction. Well, it's a Section 179 expense on heavier vehicles on the 6,000 pounds or more versus if they're under 6,000 pounds. So like that's the big benefit to going after. Like, yeah, I like F-150s. I'm a Texas guy, right? So F-150s, F-250s. That's what I see a lot. But yeah, there's all sorts of vehicles out there that are 6,000 pounds or more.
Let's take a quick break and hear from today's sponsors.
Hey everyone, it's Patrick, your host of Millennial Investing. Every year, my buddies and I do a guy's trip to escape the cold and dreary Ohio winters. Once we pick our destination, without fail, we all jump on Airbnb and find an incredible place to stay. We just got back from an amazing trip in Palm Springs, California, and our Airbnb home was a huge part of creating memories we'll never forget. I loved it so much, I'm taking my family back to Palm Springs for spring break, and we're staying in an Airbnb home my kids fell in love with and picked out themselves. While I was there, I had the realization that my own home could be an Airbnb. It's an excellent way to earn some extra cash, whether you're saving up for your next vacation, paying off some bills, or investing. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. That's airbnb.com/host.
Buy low, sell high. It's easy to say, hard to do. For example, high interest rates are crushing the real estate market right now. Demand is dropping and prices are falling, even for many of the best assets. It's no wonder the Fundrise flagship fund plans to go on a buying spree, expanding its $1 billion real estate portfolio over the next few months. You can add the Fundrise flagship fund to your portfolio in just minutes and with as little as $10 by visiting fundrise.com/millennialinvesting. Carefully consider the investment objectives, risks, charges, and expenses of the Fundrise flagship fund before investing. This and other information can be found in the fund's prospectus at fundrise.com/flagship. This is a paid advertisement.
Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days. I've noticed this at my own businesses that I've run. You'd be wise to find proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/MI. netsuite.com/MI. That's netsuite.com/MI.
All right, back to the show.
Right. I wanted to get in, if you have time, a little bit, like how you structure your own portfolio. Like, how do you invest? I kind of wanted to get into some specifics. Like, you talked about insurance a little bit, but I wanted to hear, you talked about, you've got some, since you're self-employed, you've got some 401ks or things like that. How do you think about investing for yourself? Are you like a active investor? Are you an index fund investor? Do you do real estate?
Yeah, I'm pure passive, man. Index funds. I got some bonds also. Yeah, that's, I don't know why I got the bonds. You know, they're not the best performer, but I got some bonds too.
Right.
I got the life insurance as like a, it's like, I guess I have an investment in some syndications with real estate. So I'm pretty well diversified, but hands down, where I probably put most of my investments. So if I were to get $10,000 right now, how would I invest it? I would probably only put maybe $2,000 into like one of those buckets, because the other $8,000 is going to go to my business. Because hands down, the largest ROI that I'm personally seeing right now is actually investing back into my business. And so, yeah, it's kind of hard. You can't really quite see like the green number that tells you how much you're up, but I can look at tax returns and I can see like how much more money did I make this year versus last year and go on and so forth. So for me personally, you know, I'm constantly investing into different softwares, different contractors, you know, finding ways to like not only make more money, but then like save time, just because, you know, time is very precious.
Especially now you're in the thick of it with tax returns. I wanted to, let's see, what do we want to talk about? Bookkeeping thoughts, like how not to procrastinate on filing taxes. I know I'm guilty of this, is like just putting off taxes. I dread it, honestly. Like administrative stuff is not my thing. Like bookkeeping stuff is not my thing. Stuff just backs up. Like what kind of recommendations do you have for small business owners, real estate owners to stay on top of their taxes?
I would outsource to a bookkeeper. If it's taking up too much of your time, hire someone to take care of it for you. That way you can take that stress off of your plate. Now, one thing, whenever you're looking for a bookkeeper, because you know they have crunch deadlines as well, right? Mm-hmm. So they want to get, you know, they have clients they need to get their stuff done for, because they need to take that information and get it to the tax advisor so that we can get them projections, right? So I would make sure that you have someone who is good at what they do. Do you trust them? And then have a good open communication with them. Have quarterly, at least quarterly meetings with them, so you can stay up on top of your numbers and just know in the back of your head, okay, this is possibly what I may owe come tax time. So let me start setting some money aside, right? You know, take that stress of crunching the numbers and doing the work off of your plate and go get a bookkeeper. If that's something that you want to do, that's fine. Just make sure that you stay on top of your schedule. Maybe dedicate one day a month to just solely doing your bookkeeping.
How would you go about finding a good bookkeeper? Recommendations from other people, or how would you go about finding somebody?
Yeah, I got some recommendations that I always refer to people, but you just have to ask the right questions. You know, like, you know, do you handle someone that's similar to me? You know, what is your experience with people in my industry? What is your experience in general? You're going to have to ask questions. You know, that's kind of a tough one, right? Because a lot of times, you know, people will tell you whatever you want them to hear. So sometimes you actually have to like get your feet wet and like actually experience what it's like to work with them, which is kind of a drag, you know, because everyone knows what it's like to work with the wrong person at times. But the best you can do is just try to ask the right questions. I know people, whenever they're looking to work with me, they ask me things like, do I work with other people in real estate? Have I worked with other, maybe I have like a doctor or a physician. They ask me like, hey, have I ever worked with other physicians? And heck, if they're down to give like referrals, like, hey, can you give me a referral of someone who you've worked with? You know, maybe that, you know, some people are okay with it, some people aren't. So you gotta see with caution with that one, but I think it's an option.
Yeah. How do you view referrals? I mean, that is a tricky situation as a CPA, you know, like for example, like cost segregation stuff. I'm just curious in my own situation, like we would like to give people a referral, but how is that viewed? Like in a referral fee, how is that viewed in like the tax preparation world? Is that kind of a no-no, or I'm talking about you referring, like, let's say Nick Huber's sweaty startup company, like, and he gives you, you know, a kickback from that. Is that, how is that viewed in the industry?
I found like my general small group of people who I work with. So I always refer them to those same people, and they, if they can't take them, they're very open with them, you know, but I generally give them like 4 or 5 contacts, like, hey, try these people out. They're all very good. Generally one of them can work with them.
Got it. Got it. So Grant, I wanted to get into some of the biggest mistakes. You're right in the middle of tax season right now. Stressful time for everybody. But I wanted to talk about just the biggest mistakes you see small business people make, real estate investors make. What are some of the things that you see that could easily be avoided?
I see all sorts of different ones, but, and I guess it depends on like what level they're on. But, you know, if you want to talk about like fundamental mistakes, that bookkeeping, you know, I don't know how often I run across people that commingle their personal and their business expenses. And it just makes it very difficult. It's very easy to let expenses slip through the cracks that way. So hands down, that's probably like, you know, whenever we talk about the basics, that's one of the most common mistakes I see. Other than that, you know, so whenever I like work with people, especially if I've worked with them previously, I like to look at all the documents you gave me the previous year. And then now the following year, if you don't give me those documents, I'm going to be asking about them. And I mean, all the time, you know, people just, it's a lot of tax forms, right? So it's easy to forget, but that would be another one, right? Just simply forgetting tax documents that are sent to you. Like that happens all the time, man. But it's also, there's a lot of misconceptions, right? Because, you know, so for example, the whole vehicle, we were talking about the vehicle deduction a little bit earlier, but essentially a lot of people just have this misconception when they can just go and buy a vehicle and then like they can, all right, I'm going to get a tax write-off, but they don't realize all of the documentation that kind of like goes into it. So that would be like another misconception. A lot of people think like, I got this $50,000 vehicle, so I'm going to save $50,000 in taxes, and don't even realize that they're not going to get $50,000 in taxes. They'll get maybe what, 10 to 15, maybe if they're lucky, $20,000 in tax, you know, taxable. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of misconceptions and then a lot of mistakes that I see. So it's like the combination of two create a perfect storm.
Yeah. I also wanted to touch a little on, you said that the best way that you've grown your practice is through social media, through Twitter. It sounded like Instagram was like more your focus, but you're also focusing on Twitter. Talk to me a little bit about somebody who is listening to this, who's trying to just get on Twitter and start providing value. Like, what did you do? Who did you copy? Who did you study? Things like that.
You know, the biggest thing is just put out valuable content. You know, of course, it's always great to hit them with that wow factor, but sometimes people just need to know the basics. Like, hey, you know, don't forget to separate your business and personal bank accounts. Like that right there is a ton of value for someone who's not even doing it, right? So get out there, put out good content, just go in there looking to improve other people's situation. So whenever I initially started, a lot of people get like on social media and they're like, they're constantly trying to sell themselves. Like, hey, sign up for my service. Hey, do this, do that. You know, I rarely ever ask people to sign up for my service. I provide value. Hey, here's an example. Hey, here's value. And yet every now and then, once when I've like really built up that trust and, you know, now they've seen me provide good content multiple times. Oh, hey, by the way, did you know I'm still accepting clients? Or, you know, hey, we have like 3 spots left or something like that. So that's usually the way I go about it, is don't create a social media page to try to sell yourself, but do it by providing value. People will learn to trust you whenever you provide good, useful content. And that's how you get clientele off of like social media, is constantly providing good value.
So are you doing any kind of customer outreach other than that? Or are you relying strictly on social media to bring in clients?
Yeah, man, I'm actually turning people away at this point.
Wow.
Man. So yeah. So I mean, every now and then you get referrals. So like you work with someone and they really like you. They have a group who they, you know, work with. So they'll, you know, start referring some of the people they know. But even then, you know, they refer them and they go and they check out my social media, and then they end up reaching out to me on social media somehow. So yeah, I don't do any direct customer outreach. It's almost solely now, it's basically solely just social media or, you know, referrals or people who I've worked with previously.
That's awesome. I mean, it's true. Like the best marketing is just word of mouth, like people telling each other about what you do and like, hey, this guy does a great job for me. I'm really happy with him. Yeah, that's awesome. I wanted to hear, like, when you are first onboarding somebody, like, what does that look like? They reach out to you on social media. They say, hey, Grant, you know, I need a new accountant. I'm not happy with my old guy or whatever. I've never used an accountant before. Talk to me about like the onboarding process, the questions you ask them, things like that.
Usually I start off with like a free call, you know, just get on, you know, it's a free discovery call, just kind of like talk, you know, see if we even be a good fit. So I do look for indicators, right? Because I only want to work with people who I actually, you know, would like to enjoy work with, man. So mm-hmm. I'll ask them about their previous tax advisor. You know, I'll listen very carefully. Like I try to listen to what people say and take that and improve my skills. But if I quickly, too many red flags start to pop up, that would be like an indicator of like, all right, maybe I should start gearing this conversation towards like, hey, we're kind of booked up right now. I don't know if we can take you on. But, you know, I'll ask them questions like, hey, have you worked with a tax advisor before? What was your experience? What did you like about them? What did you dislike about them? You know, you can tell a stand-up person by the way how they give you a response to what they didn't like about a person, right? Because it'll still somewhat be positive, maybe a little constructive criticism, but a red flag for me would be someone, you know, I mean, it's just the way how they go about it. So, you know, it's kind of hard to describe. There's a way how you can kind of tell like, they seem a little unrealistic, you know, with their expectations a little bit. So that's something that I'll look for. But then I start to talk to them, you know, like I'm really trying to gear in towards more of that real estate investing. So I tell them, you know, I don't really like, you know, hide anything from them. I always tell them, like, hey, you know, I could help you set up the foundation and get your 401k and like make sure that we optimize business deductions. But if you really want to get the most value out of me, you're probably going to want to like start investing in real estate, start at least consider it and just hear what I have to say. Because hands down, when it comes to tax savings, that's usually like my route to go. Other people don't need that. Sometimes people just want to know, like, hey, how much am I going to owe? Like, I just want someone to contact so that whenever I need an estimate, I can run you the numbers. You can just tell me, hey, I'm going to owe 10 grand or whatever the case may be.
So you said you were talking about ramping up and growing the practice. What will be your first hire? I'm curious, like when you think about your first hire, who would that be?
So there's so many different thoughts that go through my head, but right now I have a lot of administrative work. So I want to hire someone who could take on admin work, but I'm really looking for maybe someone who's like fresh out of school, in college, that has somewhat of a background in business and finance or accounting. Because yeah, the admin work will be easy, but now I can start introducing them to like, hey, why don't you try filling out this W-2 tax form for me? Just show me how it works. And then slowly try to build them up into like another specialist. So like I would consider myself a specialist. I would want to get someone who handles the admin, but essentially they would be another specialist.
So are you in the interviewing process now? Is that coming up maybe next season?
Yeah, so really I'm trying to get them onboarded by the summer so that I can take care of them. Because, you know, the busy season is for tax prep. January through April is absolutely like crazy, right? But then it slows down in the summer. And then we get into now the extension deadlines, August, September, October, right? I want to kind of gear them up and get them ready for that September, October busy season. It's busy, but it's not as crazy. But, you know, that's in that way, whenever I get them for the January through April, now they're like, you know, they're primed and ready to go.
Yeah, I can imagine this time of year for you is just busy. So I really do appreciate your time. I wanted to last touch on cryptocurrency stuff. So like people that are trading, let's say maybe Bitcoin or these altcoins on Coinbase or whatever, how do you recommend people keep track of that? Like I used to do that in 2017 and got totally burned, you know, in terms of my losses and I swore off of it. But, you know, there are people obviously that are doing it. What do you recommend in terms of keeping track of all of that?
Yeah, you know, you want to keep some type of like software like Coin Tracker or Coin Ledger or something like that to help track your basis and your total proceeds from whenever you're like exchanging crypto. So high level, most of the time if you're trading crypto, it's going to trigger short-term or long-term capital gains. One little caveat is that the wash sale rule actually does not apply to crypto. So you don't really need to be mindful of that.
So explain that for people that don't know what the wash sale rule is.
Essentially what it is, you know, if you sell a security at a loss, you cannot turn around and buy that same security within like 30 days or something like that. Otherwise, that loss can no longer be used to offset your income, but that loss doesn't go away. What ends up happening, it gets added to your overall cost basis whenever you repurchase the stock. So tax loss harvesting, if that's a strategy, we were talking a little bit about that earlier, you know, tax loss harvest, you want to be mindful of wash sale loss rule, but that does not apply to crypto.
Lastly, I wanted to ask you, you're a married guy, you've got kids. How do you guys manage your own finances at home with you and your wife? Like, I just got married about a year and a half ago, so we're blending our finances and that's a challenge. And I just kind of wanted to hear some of your tips that you have for couples working together.
We have joint accounts. So I'm the only source of income in the household. So a lot of the income, it comes in through the business and then, it, you know, that's where most of the income is. And then I kind of trickle that out to the personal accounts. Now, where most of the bills, I mean, we have access, like it's all joint accounts, so she can get in there whenever she wants. But I do have her own, I call it her account, but it's still a joint account. So like we still go in and access it. But I have the money transfer from the business over into like our big main joint account where like the mortgage stuff gets paid. And then she has her own personal account that I'll transfer like maybe like $1,000 a month over there. So she can just go over like freely spend.
This has been fun, Grant. I really appreciate your time. Anything you wanted to touch on that we didn't get a chance to talk about?
Oh, one thing, man. You know, so we talked a lot about real estate and like using the non-passive losses to offset your income. But one idea out there for everyone who may not be into the whole non-passive option, because again, real estate is going to be a passive activity, generate passive losses. And so a lot of people are like, oh, what am I going to do with these passive losses? Well, maybe shift your mindset a little bit, try to find like a service business. So like, for example, I have a buddy, he owns a dog poop scoop business and it's just like absolutely killing it, right? But if you would have what if you'd have been an investor and his dog proves to be busy, he needs some more trucks to like hire out, so he needs funding, and you get a 25% share of his profits. Well, that profit is all passive income. And now if you have rentals, you can use those passive losses to offset that passive income. You can build up a portfolio of passive businesses and passive rentals. So there's all so many different routes that you could go with the real estate, man. But, you know, that's just one little tip, you know, right as we, you know, are wrapping everything up.
Yeah, there's so much out there. And it's just, again, I think you got to stay on top of all this stuff and learn about it, read about it, study about it. You're providing great content on Twitter. You know, I just think like looking at people's profiles like yours, you can learn a ton. So it's just like staying on top of it. But where could people find out about you? We've talked about your Twitter account, but how could they reach out to you and get in touch with you?
Yeah, you can find me on Instagram at Doherty Tax Solutions. On Twitter, it's D-O-U Tax Solutions. Twitter has that like that handle. You can't go past. And then you could also just always reach out to me via email at DohertyTaxSolutions@gmail.com.
Awesome. Grant, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Hey, man. Thanks again for having me on.
Okay, folks, that's all I had for today's episode. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I'll see you back here real soon.
Thank you for listening to TIP. Make sure to follow Millennial Investing on your favorite podcast app and never miss out on our episodes. To access our show notes, transcripts, or courses, go to theinvestorspodcast.com. This show is for entertainment purposes only. Before making any decision, consult a professional. This show is copyrighted by the Investors Podcast Network. Written permission must be granted before syndication or rebroadcasting.